Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. It's our first show after a five-week hiatus, I think. And I'm glad to be back. Anyway, we are back at you with a really interesting show. We'll be talking to a couple of researchers about two very interesting studies that are timely in the sense that they reflect stuff in the news right now, even though one was published in 2015. And we'll also be speaking to one of our favorite regulars, Heather Part, whom you may know better as Digby. But first, I just want to note how easy it is to focus on this regime's ridiculous antics. Like on Sunday, for example, Trump started a Twitter fight with Republican Senator Bob Corker, tweeted out a bunch of demonstrable falsehoods that were immediately called out as such by various journalists. And then pivoted to new attacks on the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, who had earlier begged the federal government for clean drinking water. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence flew from Nevada to Indiana, where he went to an NFL football game, only to leave before it started with some sort of feigned outrage over a couple of players taking a knee during the anthem to protest racially discriminatory policing. And then he flew out to California. So, I mean, it was like this very obvious pre-planned stunt. And who knows how many tax dollars were wasted in the creation of that ridiculous stunt. And then to top it off, when Pence was shredded on social media for such obvious pandering, Trump himself took to Twitter to say, and I quote, "I asked VP Pence to leave stadium if any players kneeled." So, which also makes Pence look just like a ridiculous toady, a lapdog. The whole thing is just ridiculous and embarrassing. It's embarrassing to be an American with these guys doing this stuff. So, you know, sometimes you just want to laugh at these goofballs or you want to indulge in a bit of schadenfreude. At news, for example, the conservative donors are closing their wallets because the GOP has proven incapable of governing. GOP leaders on Capitol Hill are getting it from every direction. They're being primaried by Trump-loving whack jobs. They're facing a base that now hates them almost as much as they hate Democrats and liberals. So you sometimes feel like laughing at them or you get a thrill considering how awful life must be for Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. But when that happens, do keep in mind that Trump's agenda is only being stalled on the Hill, right? He still wields an enormous amount of power, executive power, and he's using it to create an enormous amount of damage, real world damage. So John Whiteside had a good piece for Reuters the week before last. Let me quote a bit from it here. He writes, and I quote, "Even without delivering on his biggest campaign promises, President Donald Trump has begun to reshape American life in ways big and small. Over his first 9 months, Trump has used an aggressive series of regulatory rollbacks, executive orders, and changes in enforcement guidelines to rewrite the rules for industries from energy to airlines, and on issues from campus sexual assault to anti-discrimination protections for transgender students." And of course, he's just filled the swamp. He just hired another industry lobbyist at EPA. And that's not even mentioning the living hell that 11 million immigrants are going through, or the fact that Trump keeps ratcheting up tensions with a nuclear-armed North Korea. That this is a country where the people live in a bubble, like a propagandized bubble. They believe that they can win a nuclear war against the United States. You know, there's a lot of scary stuff going on at the time. So it can be funny because they're bungling idiots who can't even pander to their base without stepping on a rake, but it's also terrifying because they're not all idiots. And the idiot-in-chief is easily malleable by people who know what they're doing. I guess it's hilarifying, which for some reason still hasn't taken off as a neologism. no matter how appropriate it is. Anyway, on that happy note, we'll take a quick break and then be right back. Stay tuned. Still Joshua Holland. We still don't have a complete picture of what motivated Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter. We're learning more about him. ABC reported that, and I quote, his mental state was deteriorating in the weeks before the shooting, and he'd shown significant weight loss, an increasingly slovenly physical appearance, and an obsession with his girlfriend's ex-husband. According to the Los Angeles Times, he was known for berating his girlfriend in public. That's what folks at the local Starbucks say. A former neighbor called him, and I quote, aggressively unfriendly. And we also know that he had 47 guns. He'd bought 33 of them over the previous year, according to George Zornick, my colleague at The Nation. And here's an interesting fact about gun ownership in the United States. According to the Washington Post, 78% of American adults don't own a gun. Then 19% own half of all the private firearms in the country. And then there's this group, just 3%. 3% of American adults own the other half. And that last group, they own an average of 17 guns each. Presumably they only have two hands, right? But they have 17 guns. And of course, some are collectors. It's benign, right? People collect postage stamps or whatever. But a decent number of these people are just hoarding guns, hoarding, buying more and more guns, more and more ammo. And all of this made me think about a fascinating study that was published in 2015 in the journal Behavioral Sciences and the Law. It was the first study to look at a population of gun owners who also have a tendency toward angry and impulsive behavior. I'm very pleased to have the lead author of that study on this week's show. Jeffrey Swanson is a professor of psychiatry at Duke University. Professor Swanson, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for taking the time. And let's make it clear up front that we're not necessarily talking about Stephen Paddock. We still don't know enough about him, but we could be. So to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of key findings in your study, and then we can drill down a bit?
Sure. We were looking for the prevalence of two kinds of things that come together in the adult population in the United States. Number one is impulsive, angry behavior. These are the kinds of people who, when they get angry, they break and smash things, get into physical fights, that kind of person with a short fuse. And number two, access to firearms, which we think is a bad combination. And we wanted to know how many people are there like that out there in the adult population. And we used a national survey database to estimate that.
And you found that number was 8.9% of your study group. So we're talking about potentially around 22 million people who have this rather disturbing combination. Now, the thing that made me recall your study, which I wrote briefly about when it was first published, is that there's this subgroup of gun owners that have many weapons and who carry weapons with them, and they're more likely to exhibit these traits that put them at higher risk of violence than people who have access to a firearm maybe in their home, or maybe have access to one or two guns, but not 17 guns. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. So if you think about a huge crowd of 100,000 people crammed into a big space. Now, in that group, about 9,000, you know, almost one in 10, are going to have access to firearms somewhere, in the sense that they might have them at home and they have these problematic anger problems. There's a subgroup that is almost 1,500, we would estimate. 1488 is probably not that precise, but think of that number in the crowd, who have these impulsive anger problems and they're carrying a gun with them. That might even be higher now, because the data were collected was some years ago, and since that time there's been a real expansion in concealed carry, and it could be particularly in some areas of the country it would be more than that. But that group of people, as you suggested, that problematic combination of being an angry gun carrier is more likely in people who own multiple guns. 6 to 10 or more than that, it is significantly more likely in that group that they're going to have that combination.
A number of journalists have made a connection between mass shooters and domestic violence. At least anecdotally, a lot of these people who commit these mass shootings had a history of abusing spouses or other loved ones. Is that observation something that's supported in the empirical literature?
Well, let me answer it not by talking about mass shooters, but by saying that the best predictor of interpersonal violence, serious interpersonal violence, is prior violence. That doesn't explain why people are violent in the first place, but if you just want to predict it, prior violence is a better predictor, say, than mental illness is. And violence does escalate. You know, the way I might put it is, today's fist and black eye too often becomes tomorrow's gun and dead body, which is why I and other members of the Consortium for Risk-Based Firearms Policy think that violent misdemeanors should be added to the list of people who should be prohibited from buying a firearm. Many states allow people with a misdemeanor violent crime conviction to purchase a gun. Some states like California don't, and they tend to have lower violence rates.
If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University. What other characteristics did you find were typical? By the way, I do want to get back, before I let you go, to policy issues. I'm not going to let you go without talking about that a little bit. But in terms of this study, what other characteristics did you find were not typical, but were there demographic trends within this group of people who have impulsive anger issues and easy access to a firearm?
Well, it tended to be men, younger individuals, but I think one of the important findings was sort of an answer to the question, are these individuals mentally ill? Because that always comes up, you know, is someone like this, is this, the act of an unhealthy mind? And we did find that many of these individuals would meet criteria for some kind of psychopathology, but it didn't tend to be the kinds of things like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, the sorts of disorders that characterize populations that are involuntarily committed and would thereby lose their gun rights under the federal law with that kind of rule. Instead, they were things like personality disorders and alcohol problems, anxiety, intermittent explosive disorder. And fewer than 10% of them had ever been in a hospital for treatment of a mental health or a substance abuse problem. So I think this is an example of a group of individuals who, when we say the rules that we have for denying a gun purchase of people who are risky are both under and over inclusive. They're overbroad and they're also too narrow in some sense. This is an example of people who are not captured by that kind of policy.
What do you mean by overbroad and too narrow? Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Well, sure. Here's an example. There's a man by the name of Charles Tyler who lived in Michigan, and about 25 years ago, he had a brief involuntary commitment because of a kind of reactive depression. For the next 25 years, he had no problems with mental illness. He wasn't treated for depression or substance abuse problems. He had a job. He was a model citizen. Now he decided after those decades to purchase a firearm, and he was denied because his name was in the National Instant Criminal Background Check System because of that gun disqualifying involuntary commitment 25 years ago. And he sued, and because there was no opportunity in Michigan for him to get his gun rights back. Because the premise of that was that, if you've been mentally ill ever and involuntarily committed, that that's a proxy for dangerousness forever. And it really isn't. And the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that heard that case, it's a little complicated, but basically agreed with him. So that's an example where the rule about history of involuntary commitment might be overbroad. It might capture lots of people with mental illness who aren't violent and maybe never will be. But the example on the other side of it being too narrow, take the example of Craig Stephen Hicks, who was a very angry man in my hometown in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who shot and killed three North Carolina Muslim young people in the head. And people knew he was angry. People were scared of him. He had guns, but there was nothing really anybody could do. He owned those guns legally. Now, this is an example, I think, where a policy such as a risk-based temporary civil court order to remove guns from risky people, as a number of states now have this law, would have been a good idea, because people could have, who had that information could have let the police know, and if they had the clear legal authority to do so, they could have at least removed his guns.
This is really fascinating, and I think that it kind of is in keeping with a broader social phenomenon of stigmatizing the mentally ill. I mean, the reality is that mentally ill people are not, as a group, more likely to be violent than the population as a whole. Is that right?
Yeah, that's more or less right. I mean, they're a little bit more likely in terms of relative risk. And the attributable risk, which means what it was the proportion of all the violence out there that we could say is attributable to mental illness, is about 4%. So if we cured mental illness, our overall violence problem would go down by 4%. 96% of it would still be there. But I would say this, about the mass shootings, they are horrible, as you said. I mean, they're so disturbing. They're so irrational. They're everything we don't want ordinary life to be. We want our lives to be safe and to make sense, and they're none of those things. And so we focus on it, and we demand an answer. Why did this happen? And I think naturally people point to mental illness because they think, someone who goes out and massacres a bunch of strangers, that's not the act of a healthy mind. That person must be really, really disturbed. And I would say, that's true. You don't have to be a psychiatry professor to say there's something wrong there.
Of course.
But it doesn't mean that they have schizophrenia. And the other thing is, on that very day that all these people died, probably 100 other people died in the United States as a result of a gunshot. Many of those were arguments gone bad, where maybe in another country, two, angry, impulsive, intoxicated young men in the middle of the night get in an argument over somebody's girlfriend, and somebody gets a black eye. In our country, it's more likely, statistically more likely, that somebody will have a handgun and there will be a dead body. That's embedded in our homicide rates. But we don't hear about those people. That's the unmentioned kind of quotidian, everyday, ordinary gun toll in our country.
And I think this is such a key point that people need to understand. We're talking about aggressive, impulsive behavior, and that is not necessarily a diagnosable mental illness that would lead you to be involuntarily committed or lose your right to buy a gun. So we have the screening system set up, and we're not talking about people who would necessarily be flagged if we just had more or better mental health screening, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, there are some things we could do. We could have better criteria, and the criteria we have now, which date back to the 1968 Gun Control Act, aren't necessarily very strongly correlated with behavioral indicators of risk. So we could improve that. We'd also, you know, have a comprehensive background check system.
Talk a little bit about how we could improve that.
Well, states could do this. It's kind of difficult at the federal level because, as I like to say, the whole topic of guns and gun control is kind of radioactive.
Yes.
But at the state level, there's a lot that's happening and can happen. And I think, you know, citizens have probably a better chance of influencing their local lawmakers. So a state can have a rule that goes beyond what the federal rule does. And so they can have, for example, a set of prohibiting characteristics in the background check system that work for that state. So the one I gave you before is a state has all these records of violent misdemeanors. Some states report those to the NICS and somebody can't buy a gun. Other states don't. Another example would be, people who are brought into an emergency room in a hospital in a mental health crisis, and they have a brief involuntary hospitalization for an evaluation, and a doctor certifies that they are posing a danger to themselves or others. But many times, that doesn't progress to a gun disqualifying involuntary commitment hearing, where someone would actually meet the definition in federal law. But the system knows that person's at risk, and some states would say, well, let's use that proxy indicator and prohibit those individuals from having a firearm for a period of time. Those records exist, too. We found in our study in Florida that in a big population of psychiatric patients, that among the gun suicides, 72% of those individuals were legally eligible to buy a gun on the day they used one to end their life. Half of those, though, had a history of a short-term involuntary hold under the Baker Act. What if those individuals had not been able to buy a gun? And some people go out and buy a gun specifically because they're in that moment of despair. And, you know, at that moment when someone is feeling so hopeless and so low that they are inclined to hurt themselves, and then that impulsive act to do that, you know, if they try that and they have anything else but a gun, they're very likely to survive.
Right.
If they have a firearm, they're highly unlikely to survive. So that's an important public health opportunity.
Are there any other policy implications from your research?
Well, you know, I think that gun violence prevention in our country is like a jigsaw puzzle with a couple pieces hidden under the rug, which means it's difficult, but it's not impossible. And we could start the point of purchase is an important one. We could make that work better. It would work way better if, in addition to that, we had universal background checks so that, you know, if a state just does that by themselves, that might work. But what happens is that neighboring state that doesn't have background checks imports guns across the state line. So that's another thing. Then we could have, these preemptive temporary gun removal laws. It's a civil court order. It's non-criminalizing. And that takes care of the problem of the fact that, you know, if you just stop someone from buying a new gun, it doesn't do anything to protect people from the 12 guns they may already have at home. But this removal law, which is risk-based, would address that. And then, you know, I think things like making sure that people have to get a permit we do something to try to beef up enforcement of our laws against illegal gun trafficking. This is difficult in our country because guns and private gun ownership is culturally entrenched. It's highly prevalent. It's constitutionally protected. Guns are not going away. We love guns in this country. We have a heck of a lot of them.
Yes.
So we have to do something difficult, try to figure out who are the dangerous people who are so dangerous that it's justified to limit a constitutional right. And that's our struggle. Other countries don't necessarily have to make it so difficult for themselves. They say it's just too dangerous for somebody to carry a handgun around all the time.
Right. Jeffrey Swanson, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for doing the show.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Digby. Welcome back. This is still Politics and Reality Radio. I remain Joshua Holland, and I'm always happy to have Heather Parton, a.k.a. Digby, on the show. Heather blogs at her own joint, Hullabaloo, and she is a columnist for Salon. Hi, Heather. Welcome back.
Hi, Joshua. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Everything is awful. And one thing that's really annoying me today is this tendency I'm seeing from reporters like Alex Burns of the New York Times to make Harvey Weinstein's unforgivable piggishness some sort of false, to draw a false equivalency between this and Donald Trump, or the Congressman Murphy, who was who announced that he was not running for re-election, the anti-choice crusader whose girlfriend chided him for asking that she get an abortion. Heather, are you seeing anybody in liberal politics defending Harvey Weinstein in any way?
No, I can't even imagine that anyone would. I mean, he is an unreconstructed pig. He's a pig, and I can't imagine anyone on the even center or center left or left defending that. I mean, that's just, I'm not seeing it. And the idea that somehow or another a failure to have reckoned with this earlier, or a failure to immediately return the money the minute they heard about it among Democratic reporters is somehow equivalent to the Republicans voting in a man who said, 60 million plus Republicans voting in a man who was caught on tape admitting to sexual assault, laughing about it, and, winning the presidential election is insane to me. I mean, I get it that, I don't think Weinstein may even be worse than Trump. I don't know. It sounds like they're pretty much cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, I think they're similar.
But Weinstein is a movie producer. The casting couch is nothing new. I worked in Hollywood for a quarter of a century. I know exactly what that is. I know exactly what Weinstein is. He is not alone. There are many, many, many people in powerful positions in Hollywood. It's one of those places where these powerful men have a lot of power over young, ambitious women, even some who aren't ambitious, and they use it. Same thing in broadcasting, apparently. We saw it at Fox News. That's another place where it happened. It is not unusual. It's horrifying. And in fact, going back years, I was working in the industry when the Anita Hill hearings happened, which was kind of a big national awakening to the idea of sexual harassment. And also the trial of Kennedy. You remember, the rape trial that happened down in Florida.
Yes, I do.
And people started to sort of wake up to this idea of sexual harassment. Now, that was in the 90s, Joshua. It wasn't, like back in 62. It was within the last 20 years that this started to actually become even a national conversation about this. It was so pervasive in the movie industry where I was working at the time that people were laughing about it. I mean, it was like, you've got to be kidding. And women started to speak up a little bit. But I can tell you something. If you said anything, and I'm not even just talking about a secretary or somebody who was, sort of a low-level junior movie producer. If you said something about Harvey Weinstein in a town where an industry, it's like, maybe a dozen companies that have real power over whether or not movies get made or TV shows or whatever, you're ruined. You're destroyed. Everybody knows. It's not like you can keep it quiet, or that, somehow or another you can make the complaint and it won't get back to every single person who will hire you in the future.
It's a small incestuous industry.
Yes.
Everybody knows each other.
Yeah, the idea that people, knew that Harvey Weinstein was this pig and didn't say anything, well, yeah. I mean, that's the way sexual harassment works, and especially in these industries like Fox News. I mean, how many broadcast networks are there that, news networks are there? If you want to be in that field and you have to put up with somebody like Roger Ailes or Bill O'Reilly, and that's what that's your career choice, it's, you're going to either leave the industry, say what you need to say and do it. I mean, I suppose I would. I mean, if I had been dealing with Roger Ailes, I think probably would have left the industry if I couldn't find a job at a different network. And I'm not sure it's any better at the other networks, by the way.
Yes.
But, you know, this is something that is pervasive in that industry. To compare that to voting for Donald Trump, who is the president, the leader of the free world, man with the nuclear button, and how that does not directly implicate his mental health and the way he views people in the world, this you know, the way he talked about that in that tape was indicative of someone who is completely willing to use his power to do anything. I mean, he said, it wasn't just that he said that he could do what he said he could do. He said, and there's nothing they can do about it.
That's,
I mean,
right.
That's that knowledge in his head of, I've got it, I can do whatever I want. That's
well,
what freaked me
out. You know,
out.
It comes from a sense of entitlement, a sense of, you know, impunity, and those things were not. I think we are seeing a certain cultural shift in just recent years, but those things were well-founded. You had every reason to expect that you could get away with
yep.
that. Maybe that's changing. I don't know if it's changing fast enough. But the thing that bothers me is that, so Alex Burns, New York Times reporter, he tweeted out this morning, and I tweeted back at pissed me off. He and I'll quote, he said, some Dems have denounced Weinstein, but so much of the reflexive response is to find a way to minimize association and its political relevance. Well, what is the political relevance? I mean, Harvey Weinstein was a big Democratic donor. Okay. I wish somebody would explain to me what the relevance is there, because we're not talking about, you know, we can say, like, Trump, he became president, but you could look at somebody like Anthony Weiner. I mean, I think people on the left can't stand Anthony Weiner, and they cut him loose immediately. There was no defense. There was no justification. And here we have Harvey Weinstein. I can be appalled by this guy and also note that he's just a donor. What does he have to do with it?
I don't know, and I promise that I am never going to vote for Harvey Weinstein for president.
No.
I hope Alex Burns knows that I'm not going to do that. I stand alone in that, I'm sure, in the Democratic Party, that I vow to never vote for Harvey Weinstein for president. I am out there. I am on the edge. I am making
that pledge
right now.
Look, Alex Burns isn't alone. And, you know, you get this kind of whining from the right. That's one thing. But Chris Cillizza had a similar take.
Oh.
What is it about mainstream reporters? What drives them to have this kind of compulsion with finding these or drawing these equivalencies where they don't necessarily exist? What is it? Is it the right's endless working the refs? Are they just trying to project a degree of phony fairness, or is there something more to it?
You know, I don't know. You know, Joshua, I mean, you and I've been writing and pondering this stuff for a long time, and I used to think that, you know, back, you know, a decade or so ago, we had a lot of discussion going on about the media and the, you know, the he said, she said, and the both sides do it kind of reflex among the mainstream media. And I had concluded at that time that the working the ref thing really did have an effect, that over decades of sort of, you know, absolutely just haranguing the press for having a liberal bias, that people were so anxious to find, you know, reporters were so anxious to find some way to criticize Democrats that they were, you know, would go out searching for, you know, whatever petty thing they could find so that they could say, oh, no, look, you know, I put them down too. And I have still seen plenty of evidence of that. I remember back in the campaign, someone like Jake Tapper, who I think is a good reporter, but he was really searching for ways to criticize Hillary Clinton. And Twitter is such a revealing place, right? Because for some reason, reporters think that they, you know, just they tend to blurt out what they're really doing. And I remember Jake sort of saying, you know, somebody criticized him for something he said about Trump, and he's, oh, wait, well, look, here's something I did about Hillary, too. And I'm thinking, well, there you have it, right?
Yes.
I mean, it couldn't be more obvious. But I'm not sure that's really at play as much as I've as it either used to be or that I thought it was, because some of this doesn't make any sense. I mean, you're seeing, why is a reporter like Alec Burt, he didn't come up during the David Broder years, or, you know, when you had people haranguing the, you know, the liberal media. I mean, you know, in more recent years, it seems like there's a change, but what I'm finding is that there is underlying a lot of reporters and political analysts, pundits, ever, is a real contempt for Democrats in a way that I hadn't actually seen before. An idea that there's something just really smarmy and disgusting about Democrats in a way that's different from the way they see Republicans, who they also have complete contempt for. In other words, the both sides do it thing it comes from, in my view anyway, or I'm beginning to think, comes from a total contempt for politicians in general for different reasons. But for both sides, they see them both as repulsive, and they are always looking for ways to expose that. Now, the Republicans have given them a tremendous amount of evidence of that, and Democrats less so, at least in a way that they can sort of use. So you see a Harvey Weinstein come along, and they get kind of a thrill out of being able to say, yeah, there's a certain stim. You know, have you ever noticed that among the press, you know, sort of a kind of a creepy sense of stimulation over certain stories?
I have.
That, you know, like that. So, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, obviously, I haven't fully developed this concept, but I sense that there's something more going on these days than I used to. And it's kind of a, and it's not really a political contempt, a contempt, you know, oh, they're all corrupt, or they're all, it's not that. It's more of a personal thing.
It's,
you know,
it's almost like, social in a
yeah.
way, right? It's a deep-seated social contempt, and it filters through to the public in general, because you see, you know,
yeah.
both parties are held in extremely low esteem. The rise of these independents, cycle after cycle, they are partisans. Most of them
yep.
vote consistently for one party or the other, and they just don't want to identify. Heather, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Josh.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then be right back.
There's a place where lovers go to cry their troubles away, and they call it Lonesome Town, where the broken hearts stay. You can buy a dream or two to last you all through the years, and the only price you pay is a heart full of tears. Going down to Lonesome Town, where the broken hearts stay. Going down to Lonesome Town to cry my troubles away. In the town of broken dreams, the streets are filled with regret. Maybe down in Lonesome Town, I can learn to forget. Maybe down in Lonesome Town, I can learn to forget.
Welcome back. There was a really interesting study about the media landscape during the 2016 elections, and it's the broader media landscape, including the social media. It was released in August by researchers at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society, And we're really pleased to be joined by the director of the Bergmann Klein Center, Professor Yoshai Benkler. He's taking the time to speak with us by phone from Israel. Professor Benkler, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Happy to be with you.
Now, you're the principal investigator of this new report. For listeners who want to check it out, it's titled Partisanship, Propaganda, and Disinformation, Online Media, and the 2016 U.S. Presidential Election. And you can find it online. What questions did you and your colleagues set out to answer with this study?
We were trying to understand what the shape of the media ecosystem around the 2016 election was. Who was talking about what? Who was linking to whom among media producers? And who were people paying attention to based on Twitter and Facebook sharing?
And how did you dig into these questions? Can you tell us a little bit about the methodology?
So we've been developing over the last 9 years or so with our colleagues at the MIT Center for Civic Media, a system we call Media Cloud, which essentially is a massive system for vacuuming up stories from all around the net, partly collected by just following links, partly collected by finding what URLs, what websites people are sharing on Twitter, feeding them into a system that then goes out and says, who did these stories link to, bringing back these stories, doing text analysis, and deciding are they relevant or not. And this happens about 15 times. And together we put together about 2 million stories over the 18 months prior to the election, for which we have exactly when they were written, who linked to them, how often they were tweeted, how often they were Facebook shared, all of this data coming out of the system that we've been building for the last 8 or 9 years.
It's a fascinating database. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
So I'd say the single most important thing from our perspective was we were able to measure for the first time the extent to which polarization is happening in American communications, both from the media side and from the reader side. And what we found is that there is polarization, but it's not the same on the left and the right. Essentially, everyone from the center-right, from publications like the National Review or the Wall Street Journal, all the way to the left, whether it's Huffington Post or Mother Jones or any of the more Facebook-oriented left publications, all more or less have a normal distribution in the sense that most of the attention is to the more centrist or center-left media like the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, etc. Whether you're on the center-right or on the left, the majority of the attention is to these older professional media. Whereas what happened on the right is that the more you were exclusively shared and used by the right, the more attention you got. And you had more extreme sites. Breitbart in particular was extremely powerful on online framework, but also Fox News. And then some real conspiracy theory sites like InfoWars or Gateway Pundit got tremendous attention in a way that they didn't get anywhere else in the media system. So instead of finding binary polarization or symmetric polarization, which is what a lot of the concerns about internet and politics focus on, we find a highly asymmetric system.
It's interesting. We had Jacob Hacker on a couple of weeks ago, the co-author of Off Center, and that's a book about the asymmetric nature of partisan polarization over the past 20 years or so in general. And one wonders which came first, the chicken or the egg. Let me tell you, ask you this. You first of all, it's interesting that you code the New York Times and the Washington Post as center-left media. Tell me a little bit about that.
So this is actually very, very important and a big innovation of this study. When we say something is right or center or center-left, we're not making our own judgment. What we're doing is we're looking at tens of thousands of Twitter users, some of whom are of very engaged Twitter users, some of whom retweet Donald Trump, some of whom retweet Hillary Clinton, a handful of whom retweet both, but almost exclusively people retweet either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And what we did was we looked at every site and we said, what's the ratio of tweeting of people on the right and people of the left of a site? And if a site had more than 4-to-1 ratio of tweeters from one side or the other, we called it that site. So 4-to-1 people retweeting Breitbart are only at least 4-to-1, closer to 5, to nail Breitbart, then it's right wing. If the same is true of Mother Jones on the opposite side, then it's left.
Interesting.
If the ratio is 3-to-2, then we call it center-left or center-right. And if it's 50-50, we call it center. So the critical innovation here is that we were able to find a behavioral measure that didn't require us to make any substantive judgment about who the audience was of these materials. And this gives us a real anchor. And part of what's interesting is that the correlation between the way in which we used Twitter during the election and the way that an internal Facebook study that was published in Science a couple of years ago looked at people's self-reporting of their views and then their Facebook sharing of the sites, we had a near-perfect correlation in terms of the sites with a few fairly clear things that moved left or right based on things we understand, like RT moves a little to the right because it becomes more pro-Trump. But the fact that you have one study published in Science 2 years ago that used self-reporting and Facebook measurements, and another study in 2016 that uses Twitter during an election and behavioral observation instead of self-reporting, and they're so closely correlated, gives us very high confidence that what we're observing is real in terms of the attention patterns to the media.
So the New York Times doesn't have to skew its reporting to the left to be center-left. It has to be consumed consistently by people who identify themselves as Democrats, people on the left.
That's really
a fascinating finding. Now, despite this polarization and asymmetric polarization, there was some sharing of content from the right by people on the left and vice versa, but it was stuff that helped their candidate or hurt their opponent, right? And you found an asymmetry here as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this was actually very interesting because what we wanted to see was whether people shared materials that they disagreed with so they could argue with it, or whether they shared materials that confirmed their beliefs. And it was fairly consistent when we did actual human qualitative research on what the stories that were shared were, that what people on both sides did was try to go to the other side to find evidence to support their own position.
Huh.
And the big difference was that the right-wing media was very message disciplined, so there was relatively little for people outside of the right-wing supporters to find there. Whereas the more traditional journalistic media had negative coverage of both candidates, and so people on the right were able to find things from the Times, from the Post, from CNN that helped their cause, and that's what they shared. So, for example, fact-checking sites like PolitiFact barely got any use on the right and got used only from people on the left, except where they happened to confirm a story that came from the right, in which case they were shared on the right. So the
right.
Real difference is the editorial policies in the center, center-left, and left were different from the right in terms of how clearly on message they were. And because of that, the sharing practices were different because people on the right had more useful stuff to leverage from the center and center-left than people on the left had from the right.
You distinguish between, and I'm going to get back to the mainstream media in one second, but I thought it was interesting the way you distinguish between hyper-partisan clickbait and fake news. And I want to ask you about this because I think a lot of people consider those misleading clickbait sites, hyper-partisan clickbait sites. I think a lot of people would think of that as part of the universe of fake news.
So let me just be clear, if it wasn't from the report itself. We're generally trying to shift the conversation from use of fake news, because it's become such a muddy term,
yes,
and to be more precise. So when we say political clickbait or hyperpartisan political clickbait, we actually mean the heart and core of fake news. These sites that really, in some sense, are driven by advertising dollars, whether or not they care about the politics, often, as we saw in some very good reporting from Macedonia, from Romania, wherever they happen to be from abroad. And what they're trying to do is get people to click because they're looking for political satisfaction. That's what we're trying to get people to start to call political clickbait or hyperpartisan political clickbait. And to us, that's the core of what fake news should be about. Whereas a lot of the concern with fake news that has to do with active political disinformation of the kind we saw coming from the much more major political media, particularly on the right, like Gateway Pundit, like InfoWars, like some of the stories that we cover from Daily Caller or Breitbart, those we want to make sure are not treated as political clickbait, not treated as fake news, but rather as an intentional political campaign, because we think they present a different challenge to democracy and one that is much harder to decide, okay, we're going to find a technological solution, because it would require shutting down a major wing of the American political system from communicating with a willing audience.
Let's go back to the mainstream media for one moment, the centrist, neutral media, whatever you want to call it. The coverage was negative for both candidates, but you say that it wasn't the same in effect. Can you unpack that a bit?
So it was very, this again, one of the wonderful things about having 2 million stories that you can do link and tweet and Facebook and text analysis on is that you don't have to form beliefs before you do the research. You let the data speak. And what became very clear as we were doing even rudimentary text analysis of the materials is that Donald Trump was associated with words like immigration and trade more than he was associated with words related to his scandals like university or women. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a moment, like there was in Hollywood Access, that dominated the coverage.
Right.
But as you look at the entire campaign, he got a lot of press, even though it was negative and critical, he got a lot of press that associated him with his core topics, immigration, trade. You hear Trump, that's what you're hearing. Clinton, by contrast, consistently the reporting on emails, whether it was the server or the DNC hack or the Podesta emails, the Clinton Foundation, Benghazi, consistently dominated any of the substantive topics that she was talking about. And in this regard, and this is only when we study what we think of as mainstream media, not when we're talking about the right or the left media. So this was a stark finding, because you have on one hand the right wing relatively insular, relatively distinct and self-focused, but nonetheless succeeding in shaping the agenda, such as the traditional media that have many more viewers overall, still follow the same narrative that was consistent with the Trump campaign and the right-wing media.
It's thoroughly depressing. It's just depressing. I mean, and I have to think that part of the relentless attacks on her emails came from, and I'm not asking you to speculate about this, but it came from this sense that her win was inevitable. You know, you look at the New York Times, and I'm kind of friends with Joe Connison, who's very, very critical of the Times reporting of the Clintons and has been for 30 years. And he goes on and on about it. And I say, well, Joe, you know, the upshot, their data analysis wing at the Vertical at the New York Times, they had Clinton at an 85 to 95% chance of victory the whole time. That has to get into reporters, you know, even subconsciously, has to get into reporters' mindsets. They think, okay, this is the way this outcome is going to be. I wonder how different the reporting would have been if it was considered a toss-up, if the race was considered, you know, competitive throughout. It certainly wasn't.
So one of the things we tried to do with our report was to actually combine the big data analysis with very distinct qualitative research. And we have a chapter there at the end that I think is fascinating, at least to me, on how the story of the Clinton Foundation became the big story after the Democratic Convention. And I think that story offers a much more sophisticated or nuanced or nefarious, depending on how you want to look at it, story about a very sustained long-term campaign by right-wing media activists, particularly focused in Breitbart and Bannon's penumbra, to make that a story, to prepare the ground, and particularly to prepare a ground to make it something that's attractive and interesting to lefties and attractive and interesting to mainstream media. And so I think even the focus of the traditional media is not only about not worrying that Clinton won't win and therefore looking for something, but that in the effort to act out neutrality by finding something negative about both sides and being predictable about it, they expose themselves to essentially being played or manipulated by a very sophisticated, disciplined right-wing messaging and negative campaigning that, by giving the New York Times an exclusive in April of 2015 and building the story, by releasing a movie that was framed very much to capture Sanders supporters in their anger at Clinton, they succeeded in producing a narrative that was too attractive to journalists not to report on as a problem with Clinton. And I would not understate the extent to which it was a particularly effective and sophisticated propaganda campaign, rather than something that was disinformation or rather than something that was just carelessness on the side of traditional media.
Professor Yoshai Benkler, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
I'd also like to thank Jeffrey Swanson and Heather Digby Parton. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank Hullabaloo and Heather Parton again, The Smirking Chimp, and Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in after a long hiatus. Have a good week. Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide.